This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, March 27, 2003. Bush and Blair tell the UN to help in the humanitarian cleanup in Iraq. This as casualties from the US-led war are mounting. Widespread strikes in Turkey see the battle lines drawn over big business supporters of the war and workers who are leaving work to protest the war. And in Texas, paranoid schizophrenic James Blake Colburn was executed last night. But first, these news headlines.
From WMNF in Tampa, Florida, I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A majority of the United Nations Security Council members said they deplored the Anglo-U.S. military invasion of Iraq and called for the immediate withdrawal of troops from the territory. Heather Risby reports from the UN.
Called at the request of Arab nations, speaker after speaker condemned the United States for resorting to military action against Iraq, which they described as unjustified and illegal aggression. Many of them urged the Security Council to ask the United States for immediate and unconditional withdrawal of its troops from Iraq. With increasing concerns over the humanitarian disaster in Iraq, the Security Council members are engaged in drafting a resolution to deal with the issue of food for oil program. The program was suspended last week after the U.S. and U.K. forces entered Iraq. About 60% Iraqis depend on this program for their survival. It appears the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan wants what the U.S. wants. That is to take charge of the delivery of food and other essential items. But France, Russia, and other countries are opposed to this idea because they think it could amount to legitimizing the U.S. war on Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Muslims need not apply for new employment opportunities being offered by the United States military to staff the base in Kuwait. Vinod K. Jose has the story from New Delhi.
The classifieds of National Indian Dailies on Wednesday carried an advertisement that might further alienate Muslim community from the United States. The advertisement calls for applications for sundry jobs at the United States base in northern Kuwait and read non-Muslims only. People here are quite surprised and angry to see an advertisement, first time of its kind, hinting, if you are a Muslim, you should not apply. Hundreds of thousands of Indians work in the Gulf countries on cheap labor, and mostly they are Muslims from the southern Indian states. The advertisement is given in Indian newspapers by a Kuwaiti company, Marafi, which has a maintenance contract with the United States Army in Kuwait. The company representative reportedly said the Americans don't want applications sent by Muslims because they don't want to take any chances with the Muslims. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
The newly formed U.S. Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services is set to deport a 9-member Palestinian family who own a flag business in Houston, Texas, threatening to make them refugees for the fourth time. From KPFT, Jackson Allers reports.
Houston area Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has sponsored a bill in the House that would grant immediate resident alien status to the Kesba family, but with the war on and anti-Arab sentiment growing, the eldest daughter of the Kesba family, Noor Kesba, says it is difficult to expect anything from Congress.
I think senators are afraid that if they do this, you know, there might be a backlash against them.
The Kesbas will be deported to Jordan if a senator does not sponsor a version of Jackson Lee's bill. The Kesbas came to the United States legally from Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War when Palestinians were branded Saddam Hussein's sympathizers by the Saudi government. In 1997, the Kesbas were given a voluntary deportation order and began applying for political asylum that year. But all political asylum appeals are now exhausted. The Kesbas have lived in the same house in Houston for 12 years, and this is the third deportation order given to the family in the last 7 months. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Houston, I'm Jackson Allers.
Japanese officials are now considering tossing aside their constitutionally mandated defense strategy and begin planning an offensive military strategy to complement one of the world's most modern armies. Today's statement by Japan's defense minister raises the stakes in the region as the country is preparing to launch new surveillance satellites. Miles Ashdown reports from Tokyo.
Japan's planned launch of two spy satellites Friday has struck a chord with the North Korean government. Japanese officials say they decided to put the satellites into orbit after their communist neighbor fired a missile over Japan in 1998. North Korea warns that Japan will face self-destruction if the launch goes as scheduled. But Hide Michikano says North Korea is employing these tactics to get what it needs.
They need food, and they need oil, and they are just using nuclear trump card. For diplomatic reason.
Mr. Kano works for the Japan Congress Against Atomic and Hydrogen Bombs. While the Japanese government claims the new equipment is for peaceful purposes, they've increased security measures throughout Japan for tomorrow's launch. In Tokyo, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. today sent some 12,000 extra troops to the Persian Gulf. This as the war enters its second week and the numbers of civilian casualties is growing. Overnight, around 1,000 U.S. paratroopers landed in an airfield near the Kurdish city of Arbil as the invasion from the north has begun. And as President Bush and Prime Minister Blair today told the U.N. to resume the oil for food program, Nadja Middleton reports that the carnage and destruction from war is mounting.
500 civilian deaths and 200 homes destroyed. Those are the latest Iraqi casualty estimates for the southern city of Nasiriya. In Basra, Red Cross workers yesterday helped partially restart the main water supply facility, but the city is now in its sixth day without electricity. Independent journalist Jerry Quigley, who has just left Baghdad, describes the scenes of destruction he witnessed there.
The bombing remains very intense in Baghdad and around Baghdad. They're particularly just south of Baghdad as they continue to try to bomb the Medina units of the Republican Guard. One of the bombs came very close to the Al Rashid Hotel where many journalists are staying. Bomb damage was on the fence on the outlying portion of the property. The roads from Baghdad remain hyper unsafe. They were unsafe when I was had a forced deportation about 5 days ago. They're even more unsafe now. There were journalists staying at the same hotel I was in Palestine who have gone missing, three of them that have gone missing on their way out. There continues to be massive damage on the roads with bridges bombed out, buses and cars have been bombed out, petrol stations bombed out. There are dead immolated corpses in the cars and dead untended bodies in the road. It's a horrific scene. It is most assuredly an active war zone.
Mark Harold is author of Blown Away, Myth and Reality of American Precision Bombing. Harold says that because the so-called smart bombs are so powerful,
almost three or four times more people are being killed today with the so-called precision weapons than were killed in 1991.
Meanwhile, President George Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair concluded their two-day meeting at Camp David with a press conference today. They both praised the troops fighting in Iraq, and they reiterated their commitment to overthrowing Saddam Hussein's regime for, amongst other things, they say, the benefit of the Iraqi people. Bush also claimed that the U.S.-led forces had already started distributing humanitarian aid to Iraqis, but he also urged the United Nations to join the U.S. and U.K. in their humanitarian efforts.
Today, the Prime Minister and I also urged the United Nations to immediately resume the Oil for Food program. More than half the Iraqi people depend on this program as their sole source of food. This urgent humanitarian issue must not be politicized.
60% of Iraqis depended on the Oil for Food program until it was suspended last week when UN staff were pulled out of Iraq. United Nations Security Council members are currently negotiating the wording of a resolution that would resume the Oil for Food program to avoid a potentially dire situation in the weeks ahead. But as Jim Paul, executive director of the Global Policy Forum, explains, those Bush accuses of politicizing a humanitarian issue are being very careful to avoid wording that could be interpreted as legitimizing the U.S.-led attack.
They're debating about who is the relevant authority. In the language in the U.N. Security Council resolution, there are about four different phrases that they're debating over, whether it's to say the occupying power, whether it's to say the government of Iraq, whether it's to say, all relevant parties or something like that. And this may seem obscure, but of course, any resolution or any law that's passed by a parliament, we know very well that the slightest nuance in the language can have a lot of importance.
UN observers expect an agreement at the Security Council to be reached Monday at the latest. On Friday, the UN is to announce a $2.2 billion emergency appeal for what may be the largest humanitarian mission the UN has undertaken. At the press conference, Blair also praised Bush for his commitment to peace in the Middle East. Bush announced a roadmap to peace between Israelis and Palestinians would be released as soon as a Palestinian Authority prime minister is confirmed. Hussein Ibish of the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee said lip service is good, but not enough.
Without resolving this crisis, no measure of success in their own minds in post-conflict Iraq is going to be able to bring anything positive to the region, because the question of Palestine is determinative. Palestine is the key. No one will believe that anything positive has come out of the whole experience with Iraq as long as the occupation in Palestine continues.
Today, Bush was adamant that the coalition forces, as he calls them, will be victorious no matter how long it takes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nadja Middleton.
Tens of thousands of Turkish workers walked off the job today in the first general strike to hit Turkey since the start of George Bush's war on Iraq. Teachers, doctors, architects, engineers, and government workers all joined the strike, taking to the streets in anti-war demonstrations around the country, where they were met by equal numbers of riot police equipped with automatic weapons and armed personnel carriers. As Aaron Glantz reports from Ankara, the battle lines in Turkey are clearly drawn, with big business supporting the American army and organized labor siding with the more than 90% of Turks who oppose the war.
Thousands of cheering unionists crowd onto the busy streets of downtown Ankara. The teachers, doctors, architects, engineers, and public sector unions are at the forefront of Turkey's anti-war coalition. The unions have organized a one-day national work stoppage to protest the war on Iraq and Turkey's participation in it. Under intense public pressure, the Turkish parliament refused to allow the American army to launch an attack on Iraq from Turkish soil. But the parliament did grant the United States permission to use Turkish airspace to bomb Iraq, and there are reports of renewed inquiries by the Bush administration about the possibility of leasing Turkish air bases near the border with Iraq. Ismail Siris is director of the Ankara branch of Turkey's Public Employees Union, KESK.
On one side, we have America with its tanks and its missiles and its weapons of mass destruction, every kind of plane with every kind of missile, which wants to punish the people of the world. On the other side, we have the Iraqi people, who have been under an embargo for 17 years. But despite all this, the Iraqi people are still resisting the imperialist attack with their teeth and their nails.
Most Turks oppose the war because they are concerned about the massive numbers of civilians they expect will die before the war is over. But Turks are also opposed because of the devastating effect George Bush Sr.'s war had on the economy here. After more than a decade of war and economic sanctions on Iraq, the Turkish economy is in a state of collapse, with the government carrying more than $100 billion in debt. The International Monetary Fund and World Bank are forcing Turkey to privatize its forests, its telephone company, healthcare, and social security systems as a condition of continued relations. To cope with the debt, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has also proposed huge new taxes on homes and automobiles. Necdet Akfarat is with Eğitimsen, Turkey's teachers' union.
This demonstration is against war and the budget of 2003. In this budget, there is a 0% increase in the wages of workers, and we are against this.
But as labor unions take to the streets against the war, Turkey's biggest businesses speak out in favor. Yesterday, the head of Turkey's Industrialists and Businessmen's Association accused the ruling AK Party government of drifting into loneliness for its refusal to support the war. The country's business elite worries that by opposing the war, Turkey will lose its historic relationship with the United States. Sakıp Sabancı, Turkey's richest industrialist, speaking before the parliament allowed U.S. warplanes to enter Turkish airspace.
If the motion for war does not pass, then the real war will start.
Turkey's business community warmly greeted an announcement by George W. Bush this week that the country will receive $8 billion of additional economic assistance, $1 billion in grants and $7 billion in loans. All the additional loans will go to pay the service on Turkey's existing debt, though, with no money left over to pay for government services like health care and education. Speaking to reporters at the Pentagon Tuesday, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz told reporters the additional money is being allocated to, quote, supporting economic reform in Turkey, adding that continued support for Turkey will be conditional on the continued privatization of government services here. Again, Nejat Akferat from Turkey's Teachers Union.
We think the money coming from the IMF will make Turkey a more dependent country. We are also against the IMF. As a union, we are against the World Bank and the IMF. We think this aid is an illusion.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Ezgi Sertaş in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
This week in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., protesters picketed the offices of CNN, calling on the network to start showing the damage wrought by the U.S. war in Iraq. Protesters say the media are cheerleading for the Pentagon and keeping the images of civilian casualties from an ignorant U.S. public. Josh Chaffin has this report on the media landscape during wartime.
It has not even been a full 7 days that we have been engaged and involved in this, and we find ourselves from the north.
Here's Fox newscaster Shepard Smith and pundit Sean Hannity scolding the Washington Post for reporting on questions others have raised about the U.S. war strategy.
In there, a lot of deliberation has taken place, and you would think from some news media folks that we have failed.
The fact is, this is the swiftest move in the history of military deployment.
With billionaire Republican booster Rupert Murdoch at the helm, Fox News makes few illusions of objectivity, but media critics, among them some vocal protesters, are equally critical of CNN and other networks for what they see as sanitized, pro-Pentagon coverage of the war. Yesterday, they picketed CNN offices in San Francisco and D.C.
Independent journalists, get it wrong. You're in bed with the Pentagon.
I think it's very biased right now. I think a lot of the coverage is on pro-war things about the war, and I think that our voices aren't being heard enough.
CNN and other networks have been using the Pentagon's brand name Operation Iraqi Freedom as an on-screen banner for war coverage. The media research group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting found 75% of U.S. network interviews in the run-up to the war were current or former U.S. officials, leaving little room for anti-war voices. At the Poynter Institute's School for Journalists in St. Petersburg, Florida, Keith Woods says the 500 or so U.S. reporters that are traveling with the troops in Iraq have become what he calls correspondents for the military. Woods says the giveaway is the words they choose.
You can kill an Iraqi enemy soldier, or you can take out a position. Phrases like target of opportunity that the military is inventing to put some distance between the notion that people are dying and the actions of the bombers and the actions of the soldiers.
The Qatar-based TV network Al Jazeera won an award for circumvention of censorship in Britain last night, the same week the network lost its credential to report on the New York Stock Exchange, ostensibly for showing pictures of American POWs. U.S. networks had also shown the pictures. Al Jazeera said yesterday it got 4 million new European subscribers in a week's time. Reports show Americans looking for news online are increasingly turning to foreign, especially British, sources. Labour Party MP in Britain George Galloway says that's little solace for Britons who are sick of their own media. He refers here to the publicly funded BBC TV.
Towns, we were told, had been, and I quote, liberated. They hadn't even fallen. We were told that the Iraqis were surrendering. Lie after lie after lie after lie. And the biggest lie of all, that these weapons are not hurting ordinary men, women, and children in Iraq.
An online research project called IraqBodyCount.net puts the Iraqi civilian death toll at least 227 today. The commercial media in the U.S. have come into fewer and fewer corporate hands since federal ownership laws were loosened in 1996. One company, a heavy Republican Party contributor called Clear Channel, has been able to buy up some 1,200 radio stations. Lately, Clear Channel has held pro-war rallies in several cities. The company also owns TV stations, billboards, concert venues, and PR firms around the world.
In the extreme, there is a kind of worst-case scenario.
Neil Hickey is editor-at-large at the Columbia Journalism Review in New York City.
Some transnational company that really knows not very much about your particular community, our community, they could eventually end up owning all of the sources of information in any given community. All the newspapers, the television and radio stations, the cable system, the internet service provider.
Under the leadership of Secretary of State Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, the Federal Communications Commission looks poised to further loosen the media ownership rules this summer. Fox News reported last week one of its own reporters had the videotape forcibly removed from his camera by Pentagon police, citing reasons of national security. He had recorded the Virginia State Police arresting a man of Iranian descent on the side of the road. With help from Ian Forrest, I'm Josh Chaffin in Washington, D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
Last night, Texas executed paranoid schizophrenic James Blake Colburn after his post-conviction remedies were finally exhausted. From KPFT in Houston, Texas, Eric Thompson reports.
According to his family, James Colburn began hearing voices and attempted to kill himself as early as age 14. At 17 years old, the state diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia. For several years, he was in and out of both prisons and mental institutions where he tried multiple times to kill himself. Then, in 1994, Colburn lured hitchhiker Peggy Murphy into his home, strangling and stabbing to death the 55-year-old woman. During his original trial for Murphy's murder, Colburn finally received medication for his mental illness. The drug's side effects caused him to snore loudly as prosecutors pursued the death penalty against him. Outside the execution chamber in Huntsville last night, his cousin Stephen Anderson said Colburn had again received medications that addressed his mental illness, this time making him just sane enough to be executed.
This is how he's thinking now. He says, you know what, I'm doing better. They finally found a medication that helps me now. Maybe there's a possibility they can put me in a mental hospital and I can get better and go back into society. I don't believe that he'll ever be able to go back into society. I really don't expect him to go on after tonight.
For years, Colburn's case meandered through the Texas Appeals Court. Last November, the U.S. Supreme Court returned the case to a lower federal court, granting the Texas prisoner a last-minute stay of execution. Yesterday, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals refused to hear more arguments in the case, returning it again to the high court, where it fell on deaf ears. Last night, Governor Perry approved the execution. Following his death by lethal injection, Colburn's sister had this to say.
But the same state that wouldn't help my brother just murdered my brother. And I know what he did was wrong. But if you read up on it, he said he did it because he wanted to go back to prison because that's where he felt safe. Because the auditory hallucinations cannot control his life. And he heard voices continuously. He was on Thorazine, Cogentin, or Trampoline. That's enough to tranquilize a horse. And I feel sorry for the victim's family. I feel very sorry. But I feel sorry for my family right now, too.
Colburn's current attorneys argue his original counsel provided by the state was ineffective. All of Colburn's appeals were filed pro bono by attorneys working to save his life. Co-counsel and director of Texas Defender Service, Jen Marcus, explains why.
Texas doesn't provide counsel for indigent, incompetent inmates. So in other words, if you're insane and scheduled to be executed, you have no right to the assistance of a lawyer to help you file your appeals. And it's ludicrous to think that an insane person can litigate this on his or her own.
This became something of a catch-22 for Colburn, assistant counsel of the case James Ridding.
In the original trial, the question about whether he was competent to be executed really wasn't an issue yet. The issue has to ripen, as they say in the legal terms. And usually that's been interpreted to mean you have to have an execution date already. Then it's ripe, because then you can ask the question, lad, do you know you're going to be executed soon? And that doesn't make sense, of course, at a trial.
James Colburn lay restrained in the Walls Unit execution chamber in a position creating a T-shape with IVs running into each arm, with a sheet pulled up to his chest. On the other side of the glass window, his sister wailed uncontrollably. His brother said, now there are victims on both sides of the wall, a comment perhaps directed more at the death penalty system than the Murphy family. In total, roughly 30 of Colburn's family members attended Texas's 301st execution since 1982. Cousin Chris Anderson.
Let it be known that he is loved, was loved, and will always be loved. You know, I do believe the man will go to heaven.
Reporting from Houston, Texas, with assistance from Renee Feltz, I'm Eric Thompson for Free Speech Radio News.
A second healthcare worker died after receiving a smallpox vaccination. The unidentified healthcare worker, an employee of Peninsula Regional Medical Center in Maryland, collapsed from a heart attack yesterday. This, as some high-profile officials have been vaccinated against smallpox in recent weeks, including the CDC director, the Surgeon General, Richen Carmona, and outgoing federal bioterrorism advisor, D.A. Henderson. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, Republican of Tennessee and a surgeon, not only received the vaccine, he's being trained to vaccinate others. But the program is still far below its goal of 450 to 500,000 vaccinated healthcare workers. Kelly Ramirez has an update.
As of March 14th, only 21,698 healthcare workers had been vaccinated nationwide. Dr. Raymond Strickas, who heads up the smallpox vaccination program for the CDC, says participation in the program is accelerating. But so far, only 24% of acute care hospitals across the nation have had at least one employee vaccinated. The CDC has reported 6 moderate to severe events, 5 of which involved the transmission of vaccinia virus to civilian contacts of military personnel who are required to be vaccinated. Some healthcare workers are also concerned about the safety of the needles being used to administer the vaccine. These needles do not conform with federal safety regulations. Martha Baker is a registered nurse at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. Baker says safety needles are an issue in her union.
We certainly have addressed that issue from the Capitol on down to our states and our employers. You know, they're saying that the safety needles weren't available when they bought these, but we believe they are, and they should buy the correct needles.
One company, Univec of Farmingdale, New York, makes a bifurcated vaccination needle it says is compliant with federal safety regulations. Why isn't the government using it?
Well, the process for licensure of the Dryvax current smallpox vaccine, only one that's licensed, began in late 2001 at a time when there was only one needle product available for smallpox vaccine administration. And the process went on in such a way that the vaccine was licensed as a kit. That's the way the product moved to licensure. By the time that my understanding is Univac brought its product to market and had it licensed, that licensure process was underway. At this point, then, we have a licensed vaccine as of last October, and the only needle that's licensed with it is the needle that's in the kit.
Robert Mintz is Univac's operations manager. He says that when his company approached the CDC about using its safety needle, the CDC told Univac that they had already made a contract to procure standard needles from another company and that they could not renege on that deal. Mintz doesn't think the CDC did much shopping before it signed a contract.
The CDC did not explore the option of a bifurcated needle that was in compliance with federal needle stick regulation. We hope that the U.S. government will realize that the current device being bundled with the vaccine contradicts their own law, and we hope that will be rectified.
There are still no documented cases of smallpox anywhere in the world, and there is still no compensation program in place for healthcare workers and their contacts, including patients, who might be seriously sickened, disabled, or killed by the vaccine. With the lack of a compensation plan considered to be the major stumbling block to broader participation in the vaccination program, the White House earlier this month proposed a compensation plan, but it failed to get out of the Senate Health Committee last week. The plan was to be attached to the BioShield bill, which provides incentives to private manufacturers to develop vaccines and treatments for bioterrorism-related diseases. But Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy thinks the compensation program is inadequate. Kennedy is negotiating changes to the plan with Committee Chairman Republican Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.